This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantal Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are. In the Santa Monica Mountains, Her Escape Vortex offers a unique and truly fantastic setting for your next spiritual retreat. The Lavender Garden, the fire pit overlooking the Topanga Canyon sunset, and the Moroccan-furnished yurt on this magical property provide the atmosphere for an inspiring and transformative experience. A sacred place ideal for yoga and wellness retreats, as well as cleansing and healing ceremony of all kinds, Her Escape Vortex is part of a community of people eager for personal and spiritual growth. Visit thepathtoauthenticity.com/her-escape-vortex or click on the link in the show notes for more information. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 140 for September 7th, 2021. So, I've always known that I would eventually do an episode like this, but I've been reluctant to sort of tell my complete story of recovery. If you've listened to this podcast, you've heard bits and pieces of it. But it always felt like kind of a big plunge to take for me to sort of tell the whole thing and put it out into the world this way. But today is a Tuesday, so obviously the episodes come out on Tuesdays, and this particular Tuesday is the 25th anniversary of the day that I stopped drinking. Or I should say, the first day of my sobriety. My last drink was on September 6th, 1996. So, yeah, I figured it's a good time to go ahead and just tell it. And instead of just talking about all the bad things, you know, there were a lot of dark moments. I hurt people, betrayed myself, hurt myself. Part of what I want to do is talk about what I've learned in these last 25 years. And I want to tell enough of the story to tie it into this podcast. So one of the things that you hear in communities of recovery, and I want to be clear that I identify as a man in long-term recovery, as a person in long-term recovery. So in doing this, I'm not identifying myself as a member of any particular organization. I'm identifying as a man in long-term recovery. And for me, that means I had a problem with alcohol and that I've been sober since September 7th, 1996. So one of the things you hear in recovery circles, there are a lot of slogans, and one of them is "To thine own self be true." And that's attributed to Shakespeare. It's from Hamlet. And the fuller sort of quotation is, "This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man." Looking back, you know, from the beginning of my life, I grew up in a home where there was a lot of drinking. It was customary and acceptable for men to drink frequently and heavily. I'm not sure how old I was when I took my first drink, too young to remember, but I'm pretty sure I was sitting on my dad's knee when I did it. So from childhood, looking back at my life and what I envisioned for my life, the first memory I have about what I wanted to be when I grew up, I remember having this conversation with my mom about being a priest. And, you know, I figured being a Catholic mother, she would probably love for me to be a priest. And I was on board at about 3 or 4 years old until she told me that priests can't get married. So then I moved on to aspiring to be a fireman. And then as I got a little bit older, I started playing baseball. And by the time I was in elementary school, I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player when I grew up. And that came out one day in third or fourth grade. The teacher was going around the class asking all of us what we wanted to be when we grew up. And there was this little girl named Angie Lee who raised her hand and said, "I'm going to be a doctor." So, you know, as I kind of grew up, got into middle school, the thing about baseball kind of burst. Realized that probably wasn't going to happen and sort of gave up on it, which the one regret that I have in life is that I didn't play every single pitch of baseball that I possibly could. If I had it all to do over again, I wouldn't have stopped until I had to. So, you know, growing up in this home where there was a lot of drinking going on, and I sort of admired it, aspired to it. By the time I was in middle school, I was drunk on my paper route, crashing my bicycle, got kicked out of the YMCA at 13 years old because I smelled like whiskey. Somehow convinced them not to call my mom and dad and to just let me leave. And by the time I got into high school, I knew I wanted to own a bar one day. But I also loved music and I loved radio and thought I'd be a disc jockey. Also loved journalism. My high school had a radio station, and I was also on the staff of that radio station my sophomore year. But this journalism teacher I had wanted me to write. He wanted me to write. He told me I was going to be a sports writer. Well, that spring, at the end of my sophomore year, there was a lightning storm and the tower was struck.
and the school didn't have the money to replace it. So the next year, I ended up on the newspaper staff. So, you know, that teacher, other teachers really encouraged me to write, but I chose not to pursue going away to school. I chose to instead take a year off, work my way through a commuter college where I lived, which turned out to be a poor decision. By the time I was a senior in high school, I had been drinking on weekends for several years, and I had found someone who was of age, who was willing to have my friends and I over to his house all the time and buy us beer. So we were there all the time. I was drinking all the time as a senior in high school. And it only escalated when I got out of high school. So having taken that year off, choosing not to go away to school, you know, I really didn't even pursue what I wanted because I had learned to ignore my own wants. And I was more concerned with satisfying the people around me and having their favor than I was with having what I wanted. I just was lost. But also, somewhere in the deepest part of myself, I knew I wanted to help people. I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I wanted to help people. But what I did instead is I got a job in construction the summer after I graduated from high school. And by that winter, I was miserable. 19 years old. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, what did I do? I felt stuck and sad and lost. And that was when, for the first time I ever remember, drinking with the intent to change the way I felt. And, you know, they say there's an invisible line where people cross it into alcoholism. And for me, that was it. I was terribly sad and desperate and had no sense of meaning. And I wanted my life to mean something. So over the next few years, my drinking escalated. As I approached age 21, I was afraid to turn 21 and doing lots of things to try to control my drinking. Lots of things, but not actually stopping. So by the time it all came crashing down, I was a full-time employee, also a carpenter's apprentice, which included a technical school. I had 6 credits at a time going on there. I was also enrolled in a traditional university, taking 6 credits at a time. I was covering high school sports for the daily newspaper on the weekends. I was trying to fill up all my time so I wouldn't have time to drink. And then I rushed through it all so that I'd have time to drink. And everything sort of came to a head when I was in this relationship with a girl for a couple years. It was just crazy. She wasn't crazy. I was crazy. She tolerated me. But at some point, her family wasn't going to tolerate me anymore. So that's when I decided to get help for the first time. I enrolled in an intensive outpatient program in my hometown. I remember going to the bartender at my uncle's bar around the corner from my mom and dad's house and telling her not to serve me anymore. I told my boss I was an alcoholic. Told my mom I was an alcoholic. I was trying to will myself into quitting drinking. And, you know, I thought if I tell all these people, then I'll have to stay stopped. But I didn't. And part of the reason I didn't is because despite the fact that I went to this treatment program, I wasn't honest with them. I didn't tell them everything that was going on. And for me specifically at that point, I was smoking pot. And I stayed completely clean and sober through most of that program. But toward the end, I was smoking pot on the weekends and, you know, going to groups there during the week. So I completed that program and I lasted about 50 days. And I remember it was a night. All this time I still lived with my mom and dad and I just couldn't get to sleep. My mind was racing and I didn't have any alcohol. I remember going into the upstairs bathroom and taking a couple shots of NyQuil. And that set it off. So from there, it just got progressively worse. The relationship ended for good. By the time that was over, she felt the need to change her phone number, which I don't blame her. And I was working full time still and got an offer to take this job installing hardwood floors. It was a traveling job. And I knew I'd be working 80 hours a week on average, sometimes more. This employer was going to pay for all the lodging and meals. And so I felt like it was going to be a way to make some really good money and keep myself busy so that I wouldn't drink. The first job that I went on with this crew was in Detroit. And I nearly ended up getting arrested in Windsor, Ontario, because I refused to tell the Border Patrol people my nationality. At that time, that's what you had to do to go back and forth across the border there. So I ended up, you know, the guys I was with were so mad at me, they left me. I passed out in the back seat of my boss's truck. This is a hotel parking garage at a Days Inn on 8 Mile Road in Detroit. And I woke up with the cop's flashlight in my face. He saw that there was a broken window in this truck and assumed I broke it so that I could sleep in this truck. What really happened is I kicked it out and didn't even notice. So I convinced him to go to my boss's hotel room with me and have him vouch for me, which he did. And the first paycheck I got from this employer, there was a $350 deduction to pay for this window I had broken. And he knew I was an alcoholic. So from then on, when I was on the road with him, I never went out to drink again. A couple times I'd get a bottle of whiskey from the hotel gift shop and drink it before I went to sleep at night, but I didn't even do that very often anymore. I couldn't drink out in public anymore. I was just a mess. So the next job took place in Chicago, and I was there for about 2.5 weeks working on several stores on Michigan Avenue, where we were installing hardwood flooring. And we eventually ran out of material and were waiting for a shipment from Canada. And so we went home for a couple weeks, presumably until the material got there. And I stayed drunk the whole entire time. And as the time approached that I was going to need to go back, you know, my dad was trying to get me to come back to life. So around this time, I had a conversation with one of my sisters who was a chronic alcoholic. She was the family scapegoat, but she had gotten sober a year prior. She went to this facility in West Palm Beach And the message I got from her in that conversation is you can be happy without drinking. And before that, I wouldn't have believed it. But knowing what kind of drinker she was, and also how sad I had seen her be her entire life, I knew there was something to this. Nonetheless, I kept drinking. You know, and I learned some things from my sister looking back, besides that you could be happy and be sober. Like I said, she was the family scapegoat, and watching the way my family, the way we treated her, because I took part in it too until I understood, it taught me that it wasn't okay to be sad. It wasn't safe to be sad. It wasn't safe to be hurt. And I concealed those wounds. I learned to conceal those wounds. I learned to adapt to that. But as I continued to drink, I did agree to have a conversation with the staff at this treatment facility my sister had gone to. So I called the admissions department and I talked to this guy named Alan Schwartz, who my dad, having listened in from outside my bedroom door, would later tell me I called him everything but a white man. I, you know, screamed at him over the phone when he told me how much the program cost. And my first amends was to Alan Schwartz a few days later. So I couldn't stop. I could not stop drinking. It became obvious that I was going to need to be stopped. I had a conversation with my dad the morning of the last day I drank. And like I said, he was trying to get me going. It's a Friday. He's saying, listen, you're going to have to go back to work on Monday. You're going to have to build up your strength. He's trying to get me to mow the yard. And I said, I can't do it. I can't do it. And I cried to him. And I remember sitting in our backyard on a swing, talking to him about it, and him asking me, are you sure you're an alcoholic? Because I told him I needed help. And I said, yes. And it was hard for him to fathom. He didn't want to believe that about me. And I don't blame him. So I went on drinking, hiding out in the bedroom, which is where I drank. I'd stay in that room all day long, and I'd get up to go get liquor when everybody was gone, and then I'd come back, and it was just gross. It was terrible. But that last day, one of my sisters, you know, they were all really worried about me and trying to do something. And she kept coming into my room trying to get me to come too. And I would just basically play possum and pretend that I was out. She couldn't wake me, and it worried her. So long story short, paramedics showed up at my mom and dad's house four different times that day. And the first three times, when they'd come up to my bedroom to see me, they would say, do you want to go to the hospital? And I'd say no. And finally, the fourth time, I said yes, and I went. So I don't remember the ambulance ride. But I get to this emergency room and I'm on a gurney. And I remember yelling at this nurse, being really nasty with her. And amidst this scene, up walks Angie Lee in a lab coat with a stethoscope around her neck. And she knew what I was capable of as a human being. And she saw me at 23 years old, stinking of whiskey. And she was doing her residency. And I'll never forget the way that she touched my forehead, the way she consoled me. I could just feel the love in her hands. But she looked at me and said, "Tom, what are you doing with your life?" So that was nice and all, but it didn't convince me to stay. I did know it was important, though. By this time, it was at least an hour after my last drink. They had given me a breathalyzer, and I blew a 3.9. Which, if you know what that means, it's not far from death. The staff there told my parents not to take me home. They said I could easily go into an alcoholic coma. But I refused to stay at the hospital. So, after trying to coax me to stay, my dad, my mom, and I got into his car. Me in the back seat. He got out, my dad, locked the doors, walked back inside the hospital, and called the police. And they rolled up next to us, told me to get out of the car, and arrested me for public intoxication. So, this whole time in the emergency room, I'd been saying, "I don't want to stay, I want to go to Florida." And this cop who took me to jail from there, you know, he's like, "What's going on, dude? Why can't you stay?" And I told him I have this brother who's an alcoholic and I got to get away from him. And I got to get out of here. And he was really nice to me. And thank God he was there, because there was a second cop who wasn't very nice to me. So I spent the night in jail. Notice I say I didn't sleep in jail. I spent the night in jail. And I remember just thinking, you know, what is happening with my life? This is not what I want. And just being beside myself and up all night. And I waited until about 7 in the morning to call my dad. And where before I had said, you know, I want to go to Florida. By the time I made that phone call, I said, "I don't care what happens or where I go, but I need help." And so I was out of jail. They released me on my own recognizance sometime between like noon and 2. And by the late afternoon, I was on a flight to West Palm Beach, where my sister lived and where this facility was. So one of the things that I understood very clearly was that I had to get right with God. And for me, that was, I felt like I needed to stop resisting God, because I had reasons for that were valid. But, you know, I just didn't care anymore at this point. I hurt so bad that I just let go of all that. So that's what was going on with me in this process in terms of my relationship with the higher power. So I got out of jail. One of my sisters packed a bag for me. Another one was going to drive my mom and I to the airport, because my mom had to escort me there. Just a few weeks ago, actually, she told me that my dad had come to her and said, "Listen, I know one of us needs to go with him, but I can't do it." So my mom did. That breaks my heart. Anyway, my sister and her husband drove my mom and I to this airport, and as they dropped us off, she looked at me and said, "Just go down there and do what the people say and get better." And that's what I did. So I arrived there late on a Saturday night. My sister picked us up at the airport. I hadn't showered in like 4 days. And I wanted to shower before I went to this rehab. And so I convinced her to take me to her house. And she kept saying, you know, I'm not going to let you get any whiskey or anything, but if you want some beer or something, you know, this is your last chance. And I was like, no, I'm done. I was so dejected and hurt. I was, you know, I didn't want anymore. So eventually made it to the treatment center. Got there around midnight, and one of the things that they would do on the weekends for the clients is rent movies, and this tech who was working there all overnight said, hey, Tom, you know, if you don't feel like sleeping, I'm going to watch a movie. Do you want to watch a movie with me? And I said, sure. And so we watched Mr. Holland's Opus. So, speaking of having some kind of meaning and purpose in life, that's the first movie I watched in sobriety. If you haven't seen it, watch it. So the next morning I got up, my mom came to see me before she left, and, you know, they ended up integrating me with the residential community after having been in detox overnight. And one of the guys came to me and said, hey, listen, you know, you can tell your story tonight if you want. We have an opening. Whew, you know, my heart kind of dropped, but I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. I knew I needed to get honest. So that night, I told the whole story for the first time, and I had a lot of shame. There were some things I didn't want to talk about, but that I needed to talk about. And what I learned from that is that when we're real with people, it's received with love. That's what happened. I was so afraid to share a couple things that I did. When I was really at my worst, I was not buying alcohol, and then I wouldn't be able to sleep in the middle of the night. And my dad always kept a half gallon of Listerine under the bathroom sink, and I started drinking Listerine. So that's what I didn't want to share, but I shared it anyway. And it kind of, you know, blew them away that I was talking about all this stuff, and I got as honest as I did. And that particular function at this facility where I went, the guys do this telling their story thing together. And when you go through that process, the clients give you a medallion. And the medallion they gave me had a camel on the front. On the back, it said, the camel each day goes twice to his knees. He carries his load with the greatest of ease. He walks through the day with his head held high and stays for that day completely dry. So that was the beginning of it all. By that night, you know, I was probably up until 2 a.m. talking to all these guys, just kind of getting settled in. And when I went to go to bed that night, I got down on my knees in pure desperation and said, God, I don't care anymore of what else happens. You can have my life, but please don't make me live like this anymore. And the obsession to drink has been gone since then. Because when you're really an alcoholic, man, you have cravings. There is an obsession, and it's super powerful. The worst feeling I've ever had in my life is the feeling of wanting nothing more than to not drink, but not being able to control myself. It's terrifying and baffling. So the next morning, the entire daily routine at this facility I went through for the first time, and every day began with what they called morning meditation. And the first reading we did every single day started with the words, "Keeping sober is the most important thing in my life." And I watched closely. Every night ended at this facility with an alumni speaker who was sober for at least a year. And I listened over and over and over again and over and over again. Every single day, I heard these people tell their story of how they found a higher power. So, you know, it clicked that that was really important. I also recognized that the people, like the staff who had been sober a really long time, they kept working on themselves. I knew that. I could tell by the way that they talked that they were continuing to work on themselves 20 years in. There were some key things that were said to me during this whole process, and the one that's most noteworthy is basically this particular therapist just looked at me and told me I was full of shit in group one day. And given the context of what I was talking about, it just clicked to me that I couldn't believe everything I thought. And this guy who's known me for like 3 days already knows me better than I know myself. And it taught me to examine my motives. Why am I doing this? So it was a real gift that I was able to realize when I was in treatment that this whole thing is a lot bigger than me. You know, this is something that's on both sides of my family, and I have an opportunity to change it, to break the cycle. I decided I wanted to do that. That was going to be part of my purpose. So I did everything I possibly could to learn how to be sober, to stay sober. I stayed in treatment for 30 days. Went to a halfway house for 15 months, got a sponsor, worked the 12 steps, went to meetings all the time, got involved in men's groups, did some things, took all the suggestions, but also did a thing or two that they suggested I not, but thank God I overcompensated for that. But I spent the next couple years basically working enough to keep food on the table, gas in my truck, and go to meetings. So eventually, after being sober for a couple years, I got a job at this facility where I went, which at the time was probably one of the 5 best treatment facilities in the world. And, you know, I was just lucky that I got to go there because I don't come from the kind of family that could really afford to put me through a program like that. They scraped together some money, I had some insurance, and they gave me a partial scholarship. And the way I interpret that, and always have for a long time, is God wanted me to have good treatment. And I think there's probably a reason for that. So anyway, you know, my career sort of started there, and I trained as a counselor at this place. I eventually got a job in the marketing department, By that time, I had a contract with the local newspaper, again covering sports, and that helped me integrate into PR work. So I worked there for 5 years. And eventually, with another person there, opened a halfway house for men, where she was the investor. She wanted to do it, knew it was needed, didn't know how to do it. And the whole point was to kind of raise the bar of services, these types of services. And we were definitely able to do that. And about 2 years into that, Eric Clapton's charitable organization purchased it. And I worked for him for 3 years. Got to hang out with them, spend time with them. It was crazy. And, you know, it's just one of those doors that opened. That I mean, I'm a kid from Kokomo, Indiana. I had seen him in concert in high school. Smoked pot there. And 10 years later, I'm having dinner with him in Palm Beach. Talking recovery. And one thing I'll say about him is he has this facility in Antigua that's basically a Robin Hood scheme for helping underprivileged people get high quality addiction treatment. And we're at this restaurant in Palm Beach, and, you know, by this time I've worked in the addiction treatment field for a long time, and he's asking me all these questions. And one question he asked me that I'll never forget is he looked over at the busboy, who was Hispanic, and said, "Where does he get help?" That's the way that man thinks. So that was a gift to be able to have that experience. And it's just one of many like cool experiences that I've had in my life and in my career because I got sober. So looking back over these 25 years, when I celebrated my first year of sobriety, my sister gave me my 1 year medallion. And at the same meeting, I gave her her 2 year medallion. I got married when I was sober 8 years. And not long after that, my dad needed a quadruple bypass. So I flew back to Indiana to be there for that. And for the first time in my life, really, I'm the youngest of 8 kids. For the first time in my life, I got to this hospital and my mom comes to me and says, "Listen, I'm going to get everybody else out of the room so you can have some time alone with your dad." And that's the first time that ever happened. Anything like that ever happened in my life. And she did it. And the door closed and I approached the bed. And he looked up at me and started crying and said, "I'm sorry." And I just said, "You have nothing to be sorry about. I love you. You've been a great dad." As a kid, I was dying to feel close to my dad. I never felt close to my dad. But as sad as the situation was, he was sick. I got to connect with him in a meaningful way for the first time in my life. And we were good. And I knew we always would be after that. I got to console my dad. So I celebrated 9 years of sobriety a couple days before he died. And I talked about that at that meeting, that my dad was dying and I was about to go home. when I celebrated 10 years in that same room in front of the same people, I had my son on my hip, who was named after my dad. And when I celebrated 11 years at the same meeting with the same people, I walked up to the podium and started to talk. And it was, you know, a big auditorium with an aisle up the middle. And I'm at the podium and this little boy runs up. They watched him run up the aisle and laughed. And he ran up and jumped into my arms as I'm getting my 11-year medallion. That same year, his mom and I went to Antigua to help Eric Clapton celebrate the 10th anniversary of his treatment facility and to watch him get his 26-year medallion. And, you know, we got to this place and we saw where he was. He was all with all the VIPs at like the King's table in this, at this event. And, you know, I'd spent some time with him before and we had laughs. It was great. And, but I wasn't going to walk up to him there. And so we just kind of lingered around and talked to all the people we knew. And out of nowhere, he's, you know, running around and he stops when he sees me. And says, "Oh my God, Tom, I've been looking for you everywhere." And yeah, I can't even imagine, you know, him looking for me. Just unbelievable stuff. And one of the things I'm really proud of is that I was working for a for-profit, managing a business that all the proceeds went to his nonprofit to pay for people to access treatment when they couldn't afford it. And I was able to generate about $1 million over the course of 3 years for that nonprofit. So that job sort of ran its course. It came time for me to make a change, and I went to work for this facility in Nashville. And the last day on the job before I left the prior facility, I got a call from my best friend, my nephew, who was a mess. And here I had this job where I was getting ready to take at this facility where essentially my job is to get people in treatment there. And I started thinking about, he needed help. I started thinking about who I could call for a favor. And I, you know, I didn't want to call this new employer of mine, but, you know, then started to think, well, what am I going to do? Refer a family member to a competitor? You know, so I called them. I called my boss, who is now one of my best friends. And I said, "Listen, I'm not asking for anything, but here's what's going on." And he said, "Well, I understand you're not asking, but I'm offering. Get him to Nashville. We'll do whatever it takes." So a couple weeks later, when I flew to Nashville to train for 2 weeks, the first week of which I was to go through the family program there, as all new employees do, I happened to have a family member in treatment. And I got to talk to him that day. I remember sitting outside in the courtyard of this place with him. And I gave him the camel medallion. And time went on. He went home. Ended up going back out, but eventually got sober and is sober 10 years now. So eventually we got a chance to tell our stories together at a meeting. He was there for me when at 17 years sober, I got divorced. And I had a sponsor, a separate sponsor, to specifically walk me through the process of trying to salvage my marriage or get divorced, which was a huge help. And what I learned through the process of my divorce is how I wasn't showing up as a man. And I want to encourage any of the guys who are listening to this, read Robert Bly's Iron John. Read about manhood. Find good material. It's stuff I talk about all the time on this podcast. It's important because we don't do a good job in our culture of teaching men how to be men. And I might not have ever gotten divorced if I had a better idea of how to do that. So since my marriage, I've had one significant relationship, and that was heartbreaking and eventually led me to the work of Pia Melody on codependency. And to have a clear understanding of that, it led me to do an inventory of my romantic relationships and start to look at the patterns, which helped a lot. And the man who was my divorce attorney, who I had gotten to know a little bit and I recognized as someone who not only was in recovery from alcoholism, but was very healthy from a family standpoint, I could tell he'd done a ton of work. And eventually he became my sponsor in ACA, Adult Children of Alcoholic and Dysfunctional Families. So, eventually going on to read about men's work. One of the things, there's a book called Fire in the Belly by an author named Sam Keen. And I talked about this in the last episode. The key concept I took from that was, you know, as a man, I need to find my purpose before I try to find a partner. And that's what kept getting in the way. It was always real important for me to have a partner. I wanted the girl. I wanted the comfort of the relationship and prioritize that over everything else. And that had to stop. And I gotta say, when I started going to ACA, I became really mad at God. When I started to see the whole picture of what was happening, how my history affected my present, I was mad because I was 17 years sober. Why couldn't I have figured this out sooner? Why did I have to get married and divorced and put a kid through that? I was mad. And it took me a while to get over it. But I got over it. And I've really devoted myself to working on myself since then. When 20 years sober came around, I asked Mike to give me my medallion, my nephew. And he gave me the camelback. At 23 years, I went back to that treatment facility where I got sober. And I asked Alan Schwartz to give me the medallion because I got sober at 23. It just seemed like the time to go back there. Half my life now I've been sober. So that man who exercised patience with me let me cuss him out and became the first person I made amends to, gave me my 23-year medallion, having met me as a 23-year-old. But the best anniversary that I've ever had was not mine. It was a friend. And, you know, someone who I've supported in friendship over the years. And he was celebrating 5 years. And he asked me to give him his medallion. And it was on a weeknight. It was after I was divorced and I had my son with me And of course, he had been around this stuff before. He wasn't foreign to it. By this time, he was 8 or 9 years old. And so I took him with me. I told him, you know, we're going to go. Chris is going to get his medallion. We're going to go be there for him. And we're sitting down in this auditorium, my son and I. And Chris sits next to us and starts to talk to me about how this event was going to be orchestrated and when I was going to need to go up on stage. And my son looked at me and he said, "You're going up on stage?" I said, "Yeah." And he lit up with pride and glowed the whole meeting, watching his dad. That's the best anniversary I've ever had. So, what I've really learned in these 25 years, the past few years especially, I've learned to feel my feelings and not avoid them anymore. I've cried when I needed to cry. I learned to embrace my sadness and that I can only feel joy to the extent that I can feel sadness. I've learned how to love myself. One of the things I did a few years ago was someone offered me a session with a Reiki practitioner, which I've talked about a little bit on this podcast, but it was really, brought me to tears. It was a significant experience. And at the end of that, I'm talking to this Reiki person, and somewhere in the conversation, for some reason, I shared with her that I always thought my mom wanted me to be a priest. And she said, "Well, she got it, just not the kind of priest she thought she would." And a few hours later, I talked about the same thing with the therapist, who had the exact same response. She got her priest all right, just not the kind she thought she'd get. In the summer of 2018, I had this job that kind of came to a close. I've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and, you know, a contract ended, and I was either going to go get another job where I put off what I actually wanted to do again, or go for it. So I decided I was going to go for it. If I'm not going to do it now, when am I ever going to do it? Because all these jobs I had, I mean, as much as I love them and as much as I did feel a sense of purpose at the time, at the end of the day, they were never what I really wanted. And I was taking them for the sake of security, which, as we have learned with COVID-19, is definitely a myth. So I just decided to do enough work with people who I actually want to work with, do enough to cover my expenses, and that's what I've done since then. And by the end of 2018, I had a book proposal out, and it's nothing I ever really expected to get picked up, but I needed to go through the process, and it's the first book proposal, not the last, definitely. And then at the beginning of 2019, I started working on this podcast and launched it in May. And now here I am more than 2 years into it, and it's taken on a life entirely of its own. And it's made my life bigger. And I'm more satisfied creatively than I've ever been, and I'm happier than I've ever been. And I still have work to do, but it's a lot better. It's a lot better. So, what I've learned in the AA literature, it talks about the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to drink the Kool-Aid. You don't have to get a sponsor. You don't even have to quit drinking. You have to have a desire to stop drinking. So in my experience, to be clean and sober, you don't have to believe in God, but I do. And it works for me. But what I believe you do need for sure is a purpose. I understood when I got sober that I had an advantage over people who didn't have anything to be sober for. And one of the things that saddens me seeing a lot of emerging adults try to get sober is they've started to use drugs at such an early age that they haven't even developed enough of a personality to know what they like, let alone where they might want to go in life. And that's something I talk about a lot. What we want is important. What we want is important. It helps us find our purpose. So anyone trying to get sober, or if you don't have an issue with it, you know, we all have something. Live for yourself. To thine own self be true. And if you do, you know, need to be clean and sober, you can't be sober and be fake. You can't be sober and be fake. At least not for very long. Go for it. Do what you want. Don't get caught up in what you think you're supposed to do or what other people think you should do. Do what you want. I've witnessed a lot of old timers over the years, and they always say the simplest things. I've learned that in life, whether or not I freak out, everything's going to be okay. It's going to work out. I've learned there's nothing wrong with me. This was just the way that I managed my suffering, and we all suffer. And I need to be careful of what I say to myself and what I allow others to say to me, because that got in my way for a long time and kept me down and kept me from being the fullest expression of myself. I have learned, and I want to say emphatically that, you know, we hear people all the time who say a person has to want it to get clean and sober. And it's not true. It's not true. And sometimes it's a cop out for people because they don't know what else to do. And they want to give up. It's not true. The person at some point, in order to maintain abstinence, needs to become internally motivated. The job of treatment professionals is to help people realize why they should want to be sober. Help them understand. Help them get past the denial. That's why we pay for treatment. If a treatment professional tells you he or she didn't want it bad enough, they're not doing their job. That's a cop out. I'm here today because one woman got in my sister's face when she was trying to leave treatment. There were probably a half dozen other people who were trying to convince her to stay. And this program director went in her room, sat her down on the bed, got in her face, gritted her teeth, and said, "You're not leaving." I wouldn't be here if she hadn't put her heart into her work If she hadn't fought for my sister, I wouldn't be here unless my sister fought for me. That person who approached my sister that way affected 4 generations of my family so far. My family has gotten better because that person fought for my sister. She didn't want to be there, but she stayed anyway. We don't have to want it, we have to do it. So going back to this realization that I had at the end of my drinking, that I had to get right with God, that I just knew it. There's a passage in 12-step literature. It's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. On page 164, it says, see to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for investing the time in this. I hope this helps somebody. It's helped me. Be nice. Thank you.
Hey, we need a guitar player.
This episode was brought to you by Equivox. For digital marketing or web design services, visit Equivox.com.